Blog Talk Radio.
Did you know there's a secret place to expand your mind? A place to escape the same old negative news? Welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo, award-winning author, cable TV and radio host, poet, and advocate for justice. Rose has been seen and heard on local and national TV and radio. She's consulted with victims of injustice for more than 20 years. Her articles have been published in major and local newspapers and magazines. Listen live as Rose Colombo welcomes prominent authors and experts to her podcast every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. You can call in and ask questions at 646-564-9742. Follow Rose Colombo every Wednesday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. on Colombo Chronicles Live at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. Listen up. This is Rose. Rose Colombo right here for you on Blog Talk Radio Worldwide. Worldwide. Online podcast radio. Just for you. So we want to welcome everyone from all those wonderful countries around the world for listening to Colombo Chronicles. I am the Rose, and I'm here for you every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. here on the West Coast in the good old USA. I hope you'll come and visit us sometime. It's beautiful. And, of course, there's the East Coast, and they are about lunchtime, break time, dinner time, 3 to 4 p.m. So you have to check your time in your states and your countries. But the good news is, all shows are archived, so you can listen in at any time at your convenience. You're restless at night? Tune in to Colombo Chronicles by just Googling blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. Scroll on down to your favorite author, expert, and topic. We talk about just about anything of human interest to Americans and people around the world. After all, human topics affect all of us. And it could be anywhere from the mafia to corruption to the Constitution to animal rights, human rights, pedophilia, the international pedophilia ring, and dismantling that, which would be a good thing. And it could be about health, and it could be about natural cures. So those experts and those authors are listed in the archives. And all you have to do is click on your favorite, and voila, you can listen in and learn and be enlightened, educated, entertained, and enjoy. Today we have a returning guest, very popular, and she is an author, and she also writes scripts or plays. And her name is Mary Anita Mann. And Anita has a different spelling. It's A-N-N-E-E-T-A. Very unusual, very pretty. Mary Anita Mann. And Mann has two N's, not one. Mary Anita Mann. She was born in Rockhampton, Australia, down under in Australia. And her father, Willie Augustus Mann, was an original Anzac, A-N-Z-A-C, fighting on the Gallipoli Peninsula in 1950 and in the Flanders Fields till the end of World War I. She's going to talk to us about her childhood and her father and her education and how she became interested in writing books and writing plays and producing plays. And she's also going to share her philosophy in her book, There Are No Enemies. Excellent, excellent, excellent. And we have great news today. It's exciting news, at least for me. I hope it's exciting for every American. The Supreme Court justices today, and this is breaking news in the United States of America, Now, you Europeans need to follow our guidance here. The United States Supreme Court, in a 5-3 decision, sided with President Donald J. Trump, and all of us patriots who have been writing about this issue, talking about this issue, and asking for this issue to come to fruition. So we've been on the front lines longer than President Trump, but he's the catalyst that made it happen. So hats off to President Donald J. Trump, and double hats off to the Supreme Court justices. What did they do? They agreed public schools in America, which are paid with our tax dollars, will not teach the tenets, Islam or Sharia law, in our public school. Now, this decision rolls back Obama's regulations that forced American children to learn about Islam as a religion of peace, but not anymore. So, we are Americans. We live in America. And the only thing that should be taught in our public schools is history and educating people on foreign nations, of course, educating people on foreign ideologies and laws, of course, but not indoctrination into the public schools under the guise of education. That's a different story. We are the United States of America, and we have a duty to uphold, defend, protect, and preserve United States Constitution, and to teach our children to uphold, defend, protect, and preserve the United States Constitution. And we are a republic. We are not a democracy. We have a democratic process that allows and establishes three branches of government, not one branch of government. But under the Obama regime, the three branches of government appeared to morph into one branch of government, which was the executive branch, the Oval Office, ruling our nation by executive order, bypassing Congress, bypassing the Constitution of the United States. Executive orders were never intended to make law. The only body established by the United States Constitution that can make laws in the United States of America is the Congress. And they are obligated and by duty and responsibility, common sense, and fiduciary duty to read every law, to read every mandate, to read every punishment, fine, and excessive fines, excessive punishment. And they are to study these variants, and they are not to approve of any law that is not in accordance with the United States Constitution and the will of the American people. In fact, they are not to pass laws that do not adhere to justice, fairness, common sense, quality, or all. But yet they have been doing that over the past decade or so. They have been passing laws that are not in accordance with the U.S. Constitution. In fact, some of those laws, such as the asset forfeiture law and the search and seizure law and the NDAA law, deny due process of law to the American people and their Miranda rights based on accusation only. So we have to take a look at those laws in the future on a different show, and we'll discuss them more in depth as to why they are not following in upholding due process of law and Miranda rights as guaranteed to every American in the United States of America. Very, very interesting indeed. Maybe we can get Attorney Philip Rehberg to come on the show shortly, maybe in the next month or so, and discuss those issues with us. He's an expert on constitutional law. But now we're going to enter into the world of authors and experts, and we have our returning guest, very popular guest. Her name is Mary Anita Mann. She was born in Down Under, Australia, Rockhampton, Australia. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to be talking to Mary Mann about some of these important issues.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure, be sure to bring your appetite.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
That's right. Listen up. You're listening to The Rose, Rose Colombo, right here at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. You can listen to all archived shows by doing that. And today we are going to enter into the world of authors and experts with Mary Anita Mann, who was born in Rockhampton, Down Under, in Australia. Her father, Willie Augustus Mann, was an original Anzac fighting on the Gallipoli Peninsula in 1915 and in Flanders Fields till the end of the war. And Mary came to the United States to pursue her education. She'll tell us a little bit about that and about her book, There Are No Enemies, which explores a practical philosophy of life for humankind based upon reverence for life and the science of being altogether, first offered by Aristotle, the philosopher. So let's get started, because heaven knows we need more of this peace, world peace, and reverence for life to be implemented in America and around the world. So let's get started, because this is an exciting topic. Hi, Mary. How are you this morning?
I'm very well. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you back, and we're looking forward to hearing about your story, especially the new listeners, and refreshing the minds of those who have been with us before. And Mary, one of the first questions I wanted to ask you, because you're originally from Down Under, Australia, and what is it that you liked about growing up in Australia? And can you tell us a little bit about your father and your childhood?
Yes. Well, my father, as you said, was in the First War. He was on the Gallipoli Peninsula. And then from there, he survived that. And then he went over to France. And he was reported killed at the Battle of the Somme. His brother was also reported killed. His brother was killed. But he survived that. And then he went through the rest of the war. And he was reported killed again in 1917. And in each time, he felt that it was Providence that saved his life. And through all those war years, apparently those soldiers at that time believed that if they survived that war, it was Providence. And so then he came back to Australia, And he had enlisted in 1914. He was on the Kanauna, and that was the first ship that sailed from Australia at the beginning of that war. Most of those soldiers fought on Gallipoli, and they were killed. And they came from, a lot of them came from his hometown. So when he arrived back, there were only one or two soldiers who came back. So that town became something of a ghost town. But my father then married my mother, came to another town called Rockhampton, and I had an absolutely wonderful childhood. But when I was 10, my father was told that he had 5 more years to live. And so at that time, he told us all that we had to take care of our mother, do what our mother told us to do, and prepare ourselves so that we would just get 2 years of high school and then we would be out on our own. But the thing that he didn't specifically teach us, but he taught us through his life, was to cherish everything. So we had so much fun. We had so much fun during our lifetime. He bought a Model T Ford. He took us out every Sunday afternoon. My mother was, she loved him so much, and he loved her. I think the thing about my childhood that I treasure the most is that my parents loved each other. It was a very, in many ways, scary existence because we treasured every single day we ever had because we didn't know whether what was going to follow after that. And I think sometimes people go through terrible experiences like that, and I noted recently John McCain was something like that. When they go through a really deep experience, they find a sense of humor beyond it. And there was always something good that came out, and he would always sort of laugh. He made these most crazy jokes. I mean, I would laugh so much that I'd have to hold my sides laughing at his jokes. And he was strict in a way. We all had our rules that we, you know, but we all sort of obeyed them because that's what we wanted to do, you know. And then my mother was very religious, but my father was not, because during the war, the only people that were in the trenches were the Salvation Army. So he was only interested in the Salvation Army. And my mother was raised in a convent, but we went to a Church of England in Australia, which is Episcopal here. But he wouldn't. He would drive the car and park outside, and my mother would go to church. But they never ever. After she died, he wrote a couple of really beautiful poems about her because she ended up dying first. And he wrote a couple of beautiful poems about her. And so I had a really wonderful childhood, and it strengthened me. And my father was never afraid of anybody or anything. And my mother loved absolutely everybody and everything that she ever met. And so that was the basis for me for my whole life, because I can always find something good in everything and in everyone. And it just gave me a sense of hope. When the Second World War began, I was 9 years old. And that was a terrible thing, because the First World War for us was the war to end all wars. And we really believed it. So when that Second World War began, it was a horrific thing. My father tried to enlist, but of course he couldn't. I was 9, and I wrote my first time, and I just remember one line of it, soon there'll be death and destruction no more. So from that time on, because of what he had been through and what Anzac meant to Australia, I just dedicated my life. Somehow, not that I really chose it, but yet it was something that I felt that I had to do, and that was I had to find out why we had wars and what we could do to stop it. And so I studied real hard. I only had 2 years of high school, but I kept on studying, and then I went through the University of Sydney. I studied a lot of philosophy, the University of Sydney. That's where I met up with Aristotle and all of the Greek philosophers. I happened to have a very fine philosophy teacher. And Aristotle was something about all of them that was wonderful. But Aristotle talked about the science of being altogether. And he talked about the prime mover. And that was very fascinating to me, but I didn't use it for quite a long time afterwards. I came then to America because my sister was already here. She had married a beautiful, beautiful soldier, American soldier, because my hometown of Rockhampton was on the tropic of Capricorn. So when the Pearl Harbor was struck, the Japanese, prior to that, the Japanese were coming into Australia, and they bombed a couple of towns, towns where my grandma was. But then they turned to Pearl Harbor. They made a big mistake because when they hit Pearl Harbor, that brought America into the war. And the next year, our town was just, we had as many soldiers out just outside our town as we had residents in the town. Of course, it was an absolutely wonderful time for the children because, you know, the Americans would do things. They would have events, you know, at the showgrounds, and the children would line up on one side and soldiers would line up on the other, and we'd take a hand so that an equal number of children always participated in all of the wonderful things that they would do for the soldiers. And then they would train there before they went up to Port Moresby to fight, you know. So it was a wonderful time for us. My sister was the only one in our family who was old enough to go to the Second World War. She was 18 when it began. Had she been a boy, she would have gone to North Africa and probably got killed. But being a girl, she could only join the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, the WAF, they called them. So she joined the WAF. And then she met this beautiful man who we loved him. He just kind of came into our family because my mother used to bring home soldiers all the time and we'd have them for dinner and all that kind of thing. And so my sister married one of them, but she was still in the Air Force. She couldn't get out for a while. He actually got back to America before she did. And then so they were already in America. So then I married a Polish person who had gone through a lot of bad experiences with the Russians and was, as a child, was in Siberia. But he finally escaped from that. The Germans and the Russians both had, he was stateless, but even being stateless, he had to wait 5 years to come to America. But then we came over to America for a few years. I worked while he got his degree. Then we went back to Australia and I got this honours degree that I was talking to you about. But then I came back to America by myself because I knew I had to keep working. And I got to Berkeley. And that's when I thought that the way to find world peace, was that, because I'd studied so much philosophy, was for me to write a classical tragedy because I had read all the classical tragedies. And I thought maybe that's the way to go. So I studied very hard at Berkeley and I got the master's degree at Berkeley. And I was getting close to realizing we had to study all of Shakespeare's plays. And I wrote my big play then, Anzac, at that time. And it turned out in iambic pentameters because of all the work that I had been doing with Shakespeare. Then I realized that writers usually accept the philosophy of the day. Shakespeare was just through his gut, I think, was just so connected with Aristotle that when he wrote King Lear, was close to a classical tragedy. In other words, he could have written it in the time of the Greeks, you know, because the life values were the same as they were for the Greeks, and you knew right from wrong, and so on. And of all of the people who were writing it, his time, that's why Shakespeare has survived, because he has given us so many beautiful things which teach us things about what it's like to be a human being and, you know, the difference between right and wrong and so forth. However, I had to leave Berkeley after I got my master's degree because they were not letting, because being a woman, you always get a lot of discrimination. And I did even a little bit in Sydney and all through my life, actually. But at the end of the master's degree, women were not getting through the PhD program. And I knew that I had to study more because I still didn't know why we don't have these wars. I had not found my philosophy. I actually wrote a whole book about it. It's called Anzac to Understanding, and I've tracked my steps to find my philosophy and the things that I did while I was searching for it. And then I came to USC to do my PhD. And when I realized when I was studying additional plays like A Man for All Seasons and The Condemned of Altona that I studied, and I wrote my dissertation on that, then I realized something had happened in the 20th century, started happening in the 19th century, that humanity was shifting its focus. We were losing our sense of understanding of really who we are, what our allegiance is to, which is the God of the universe, and that the philosophers had not been keeping up with it, that the writers, when those writers wrote the plays, which were very lovely plays, they were not classical tragedies. They were not able to teach us how we can get past the problems that that we are facing now, because the core, there was something gone with the core of humanity. And that was very devastating for me, because that meant that I was not going to be able to write a classical tragedy, not because I didn't know how to write one, but because the world had changed so much that it was no longer possible. And then I realized that the thing that had entered our world was money. Capitalism's only been going for a couple of hundred years, and capitalism is a very good thing, you know. You make a lot of money, and it has two parts to it. You make a lot of money, and then you make money, and then you take money. And the making of the money is capitalism. But then when you make that money, the problem arises with the taking of the money, because that money has been, in the past, taken by just a few people. And so there are just a few people on the top who are holding a whole pile of money, a lot more than they need and everything. Why? Because of the way capitalism works. So then I thought, okay, we now have to move beyond... first of all, we have to understand who we are as human beings and what our allegiance is. And right up until this time, we're all connected to what I'm calling the life force of the universe, which is God or any name, by any name or no name. And our connection to it is our conscience as being human beings, because we consider ourselves...
On that note, Mary, I want to come back and discuss that about... I want to talk about your book, There Are No Enemies, because that philosophy affects that book, There Are No Enemies, which fascinates me and the audience. So hold on a second, and we'll be right back to Colombo Chronicles in just a moment.
Listening is an art that humans are losing to the world of robots. Robots don't have any tone or human feelings. The addiction to communicate by texting isn't going away. People are feeling isolated, lonely, frustrated. People need people willing to listen to them. Can you imagine getting a text message that read, "You're fired," or "Hi, would you marry me?" It is happening. Colombo Chronicles is the option and the answer to human communication. Colombo Chronicles provides email access to your ideas and issues. Take advantage of this opportunity now. Go to ColomboChronicles.com. Click on subscribe today. Colombo is spelled C-O-L-O-M-B-O Chronicles. Fill out the form, submit it, bookmark and subscribe today. Remember the name, ColomboChronicles.com.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Yes, listen up to Colombo Chronicles Live. We're talking to our very special guest, Mary Anita Mann, and that's with two N's, M-A-N-N. And she's from down under Australia, and she wrote the book, There Are No Enemies. And she's about to talk to us about capitalism and the fourth light force and peace in the world and how to attempt to accomplish such a huge, monstrous task, which so far we haven't been able to do. But so this is going to be extremely interesting on her philosophy. She has a PhD from USC, and this is her life study. She's written plays and books, and so she is an expert on these topics in our world of authors and experts every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. here on the West Coast. You can check your state and the time in your countries and tune in every Wednesday live. Google blogtalkradio.com/Columbo Chronicles and scroll down to your favorite author and expert on your favorite topic and listen at your convenience. And the great news today, if you missed it, is it's breaking news. I think it's extremely important decision by the Supreme Court. It is a 5-3 decision, and the Supreme Court sided with President Trump, who agreed public schools will not teach the tenets of Islam or Sharia law. This rolls back Obama's regulations that forced children to learn about Islam as a religion of peace, but not anymore. So that's a very important decision because we are the United States of America. Not that we can't expand our mind and learn about other religions, but it shouldn't be an indoctrination under the guise of education in the United States of America. So let's expand our mind some more and let's get back to our guest and talk about capitalism and the force of light and peace in the world as written in the book, There Are No Enemies by Mary Anita Mann. So let's say hello again to Mary Anita Mann. Hi, Mary. We're back, and you were talking about capitalism and world peace and the force of light.
Yes, and I was just listening to what you said about in this book. I also talk about, you know, Aristotle's philosophy and integrated world view, where everybody in the world is part of the universe. I also belong to another organization called Unity and Diversity, where we try to bring all of the religions together, and we say spirit is one, the spirit of the universe, which is the God of the universe. Paths are many. We walk many paths in our lives, you know, and religion has many paths. It has Christianity, Judaism. We wrote another book called Science and Spirituality, which talks about that. But in this Aristotle and in this book, it's an integrated worldview, which does include everybody. But getting on to capitalism, I was explaining, was in two parts, the making of the money and the taking of it. And in the taking of the money, if only a few people take the money, as has happened in the past through corporations, we have to realize that in order to get that money, this money doesn't really belong to one person. Money is not a thing. It's only a coin, it's a chip. All by itself, it's nothing. It's really only the oil that greases the machines that that we work with. And if through capitalism, the taking of money through capitalism, people who just consider money as their goal, they take all of the returns of any enterprise, and it's in the hands of a few. But if you consider how that money was made, take for instance an oil well, in order to get all that oil that makes all that money, you have to use a whole lot of people, and you have to go into Mother Earth, and you have to take a lot of material from the earth. So although we don't have it now, there's a vision which I do believe will come to pass because of the work that I have been doing, that our civilization will move to a point where we will have like something like a court of the wise, which will consider that money as in a way that is proportional to life itself, proportional to a human being. For instance, we're all human beings, and you can tell, you know, the smallest one, the tallest one, and there is an air of proportionality about us, about trees, about every living thing. And because our philosophy is pretty slow to catch up with this, but we are catching up and we will catch up more, we have to find a way to bring money into organic harmony with human beings. And it sounds ridiculous quite now, but in the future, there will be a certain amount of money only allocated to one human being. That and money is you can money is not a thing. It's only what is in the hands of other of people. You know.
Is that part of the Mary? Is that part of the redistribution of wealth?
Yes, and that's how it can be done with justice and equitably. And see that what is happening now is people who just work for money, just, you know, that how you tell what your God is you make, if you're in a moment of choice, you're going to choose for your God or you're going to choose for money. Like, supposing a bag of money fell off a truck on the street and you look at it and you know very well that bag of money is not yours, it belongs on that truck, but, you know, it's money. So if you owe allegiance to the God of the universe, your conscience will tell you, hey, wait a minute, you got to get that truck driver and you've got to put that money back. You know. But if your allegiance is to money, then you're just going to grab that money and you go. Okay. Now, there's a big difference between those two situations. One situation is that you recognize your conscience, which is something we all have, and then the other one is that you throw that conscience to the winds and you just say, hey, I'm just going to go for the money. Now, when you put that, you know, move that into other situations, like any kind of business that you do or anything that you do in your life, if you only consider money, you don't need to have a conscience, you see? And so this is putting us in a very difficult situation right now because we have a lot of people who are just choosing for money, but truth always prevails in the end. And that brings me to the point of truth itself and our intelligence.
Well, let me ask you this, Mary.
Yes.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
The world now is focused on money, and because you can't live without money. But the bulk of the money is at a very, very small percentage of people who actually control the money. These people become very greedy, and they do not want to let go of any money. And then they use people in other countries for maybe working 25 cents a day, 40 cents a day, or even an hour, which is nothing. But it's something to them because they're so poor. And so then these CEOs go into these companies. They use these poor people and for cheap labor. And then that hurts the American people because now their jobs are being reduced and diminished, or their hours. And so then they're over there using these people and saying, well, look, we can sell it to you Americans for a lot less. But in the end, it is just a vicious cycle, and the people never win, whether they're the poor in the third world countries or the middle class Americans trying to struggle to put bread on their food. The only people that keep winning, it appears, is if you're in that small percentage of the very wealthy people who control it. What do you think?
Yes, that's exactly the truth. That is what's happening. But that's because philosophy has not caught up with what has happened. Money has is inorganic. It's floating out there by itself. And the philosophy has not caught up with bringing that money into harmony with organic nature. Like getting human beings to understand that there's a law of proportionality in all of nature. And human beings are part of nature. They control the money. And so in the long run, there needs to be a law of proportionality attached to the money that is attached to the small amount of human beings. And looking way into the future, which we have to get to if we're going to survive, there'll be something like what I'm calling a court of the wise, which will be philosophers who will start educating the people who are making all this money and explaining to them how they are human beings and they are, depending on their country, they are entitled to, you know, make a whole lot of money, but there is a limit. There needs to be a limit to what one human being can control in terms of money. And in this country, you know, an annual salary, something like that, you can put it, I'm just putting it for, you know, say, $1 million a year, which is, you know, really wild. But at the same time, a lot of people make more than that. So if the country decides, and they can easily do it, what is an upper limit for people to really have a fabulous life in this country? And then the government says, okay, that's your limit, guys. When you hit that limit, the money that you make beyond that goes into the community. Why? Because you are part of the community. You were brought up by the community. You owe your life to this community. And so you really and truly do not have the right to more money than what this government has determined is the utmost limit for one human being to make. That doesn't mean to say that you can't get on, which will be developed eventually, some kind of boards. Like, for instance, there are a couple of very famous people, Zuckerberg and Gates, for instance, just for examples. They understand the situation, but they don't have philosophy to back up how they can make this thing better. And the both of them are trying to make things better. Like Gates puts his money, but he determines where his money is going to go, see? And we need... Go ahead.
Well, being a philosopher, Mary, when you take the negativity in the world and the corruption in the world that always goes back to money, most of the time either it's money or sex or control and power, or it could be in any of those orders, but mainly it's money.
Yes.
Because money can buy sex and money can buy power and control. So I put money first. And so as the god of these people who worship it. And so when you look at the fact that there are good people and there are really bad people in the world, and because we wouldn't have prisons if that wasn't true, and we wouldn't have courtrooms to have to teach people to be good or bad or punish them or settle money issues in the courts. And so then when you, let's take an example, you have, let's say, judges who are taking a bribe or attorneys who are selling out their clients for money. And then maybe you have a prosecutor who was sold out, or maybe you have politicians who took a bribe. So how in the world do philosophers determine that they can change, since time began, the corruption of good versus evil in the world?
I believe that philosophers have to get down to brass tacks and describe in very simple terms what our lives are all about, and to begin educating people so that taking the things that we're all born with, we're all born with creativity and we're all born with a conscience, and the best thing would be to start in the primary schools, but to write philosophy in such a way that the average person can understand that there is such a thing as character, and we have, like, the 20th and the 21st century, all these things that you're talking about, they existed before, but not to the extent that they do now because of money. And if we can just write the philosophy out of what it really takes to pay attention to your conscience and to always act according to your conscience and make money a secondary part of your life, not the primary part of your life, and we can reach enough people, because the average person, my understanding, my belief, since just being an ordinary person always, is that the average and the ordinary person really has a good sense of right and wrong. They really know the difference. And they just get put in a position where, like the most extreme, I suppose, would be something like a country, something like Russia, where beautiful people live in that country, but because the government has been allowed to move and take control of so many aspects of governing the country, they are unable to live freely as we live freely. So we as philosophers have to reach the average human being who votes in a free country, and we have to understand all the important parts of freedom, because freedom allows the average person to have a voice. And as long as we have the average person with their voice paying attention to their conscience, we can pull out of all of this corruption. We can pull out of it. But it's going to take an education showing people that it's important that they understand certain things about their, and for instance,
well, I live near the beach, for example.
Yes.
And
yes.
When I was growing up, there was nothing but sand and open land, and then further in there was lots of farms and fruit trees and, you know, so forth, and strawberry patches,
yes,
and things like that.
Yes.
And so we would just park on the side of the street, pull up and park on the side of the street and walk on down to the beach. Then
yes,
it started slowly where the developers came in and they started building parking lots,
yes,
on the beach with gates, so you had to pay to get in to the beach with your family. And then you had to, you know, and then they built the snack bars and all that, and it's all cement. Then came all, little by little, they start building up the town. And then before you know it, they start building more hotels and more restaurants. There isn't a space left near the ocean where there isn't developers who haven't gobbled it up for money. And all that nature that was there and the kids today will never, ever know or see is gone.
That's true. That's true.
And we're talking about a lot of birds, a lot of birds that we used to see, a lot of different butterflies. I mean, I'm talking about nature. There,
yes,
people don't believe it. We used to see tons of butterflies, those little bumblebees, the little ladybugs, all those things, they're gone.
That's reverence for life, and we can't go backwards. That is what has happened. Because before people became aware of the significance of understanding that we must bring money into harmony with organic nature. For instance, when you're talking about all of that development, had people had the awareness that we're beginning to get now of how important these little critters were, when this development was taking place, there would have been allowances for things like that. There would have been spaces allowed, and the development would have not been so high and not been so obstructive. We can't change that, but we can start now. And every time we see, reverence for life is very important. Every time we see life of any kind that's being in a democracy, that's why the single person, the single human being is the most important thing in a democracy, because the single human being is closest to God. The single human being has a conscience, understands right from wrong. So now they have to make their voices heard and not feel discouraged. So many people are feeling discouraged now, and they can't give up, however, because if they give up, this country will end up in a country, something like Russia, where they are not able to make a whole lot of choices. So they have to start, and the education needs to begin right now, and they need to start thinking about who they really are and how important it is for them to vote, how important it is for them, like what's happening on the Supreme Court right now with Kavanaugh. God knows how that's going to happen. But defects have been found in that character, and people have to take it upon themselves of making their voices heard. In Australia, voting is compulsory, and people in this country are very sort of, they don't seem to like that. But if everybody votes, and you mean you have to go out there and you have to vote, even in Australia they'll send people to hospitals and retirement homes and everything to make sure that they get everybody's vote. When you vote, you've got to sit down and you've got to look at the people, and you've got to look. This is your responsibility. This is the benefit you get from being in a democracy. So you look at that person and you look at that person's character, and when you find flaws in that person's character, like when people lie and stuff like that, you think, okay, they're not going to get my vote. So then you vote for people that have character, like what Martin Luther King was saying, I can see it, I might not get there, but it's out there, but it's depending upon every individual human being. So everybody gets to vote, and they vote their conscience, then automatically, and they only vote for people who have reverence for life, who are not going to kill anybody. You know, like somebody said recently, he could shoot somebody and his people wouldn't worry. Well, that's not exhibiting reverence for life. And the average person should stop dead in their tracks and say, wait a minute,
so
that's killing.
Let me ask you this, Mary, then on this force, this light force
yes.
philosophy.
Yes.
Well, what do the philosophers who agree with that and the redistribution of wealth believe about mandated taxpayer-funded abortions, because that is destroying lives at birth and sometimes even after birth, and the depopulation program under the United Nations Agenda 21 that I believe they've changed to Agenda 2030 now. So what do they think about the depopulation program?
Well, philosophically, everyone has to study. We do have an overpopulated world, you know. But there again, it comes down to the human being and the woman in particular, because the woman gives birth. And people have to decide when they agree that something is living. Now, nature, the animals around us and everything, they agree that something is alive when it comes out of the mother's womb. Like you have an animal and they drop a baby, okay? Then that's part of the life. Now, humans is
right.
A little bit different. Humans are a little bit different, but philosophically, this just has to be debated. And I think that it might turn out to be just something, a decision of when something really becomes alive, you know, at what point it becomes alive, and then in the country they can say, okay, at this point we're going to decide this is what it becomes alive. But as far as reverence for life goes, this is a woman's body, and, you know, the Australian Aborigines, they have some philosophy about this, that the soul, sometimes the souls, that the soul picks which body it's going to go into. And sometimes it's really better if some of these children stay in the netherworld until they get into a body that's going to be welcoming for them. Because philosophically, if you look at a child who was born unloved, has a terrible existence, and there was an opportunity to tell that baby or whatever, what at a certain point in its development, sweetheart, you'll be better to stay in the netherworld because you, but the, each government can make the decision about that. But globally, that's why we need to have a court of the wise, because globally, it seems we're getting overpopulated. And so therefore, you know, like China had a one child for a long time and nobody was upset when, you know, however they handled it, I don't know, in China, but they were only allowed one child. So
either do it or fly or die, I think.
I haven't gone into the details of that, but we are able to control our population. That's what I'm saying. We are able to control it, but the important thing
is... Well, when you look at countries like the Middle East, they overpopulate, and they don't believe
yes.
in contraceptives over abortions, and neither do they
yes.
over in Africa so much. And so
yes,
the United States is trying to go into Africa right now and convince them to get abortions and contraceptives. So so what about those countries that have no desire to take contraceptives or abortions?
Well, there again, it's a matter of education. You know, it's a matter of, you know, how many in some countries, like, for instance, when war was after the first or second, I don't know whether it was after the First or Second World War, but the Australian government made this decision, populate or perish. Australia had to populate. So then everybody was anxious to have children. The government even gave them little bonuses if they had a lot of children. And that was education. You know, that was education. So depending on what country that you're in, people can be educated. It's all education. But the main thing is that the woman really basically the woman really has, it's her womb, it's her body, and the woman needs to determine when she wants to have, because a child is, you're a mother forever. You have a responsibility. You give birth to a child, you have a responsibility for the rest of your life. There are a lot of women who don't want that. They're not good at it, and they shouldn't have it, you know. So they need to be.
I think those women have in America, everybody has a choice because you have contraceptives. So of
yes.
all kinds, you have free contraceptives,
yes.
clinics.
Yes.
So in America, I don't even understand how there could be so many abortions when there's so much education on contraceptives and they're so accessible. That just kind of boggles my mind, you know, that it shouldn't even be an issue in America, but it is.
it's education, making sure that everybody understands it, and that, you know, people are always going to have their thoughts about things, but I think each individual woman knows, you know, whether she wants to have this child or whether she doesn't. You know, and if it's going, she
kind
should have that.
It's kind of a twofold thing, though, because I didn't mean to get off on this, but it's kind of a twofold thing because there's a father involved, and sometimes the father wants the baby, and then the mother says no, so the father doesn't get to have the baby, even though he's the other parent. And then there's the grandparents who say, well, I'll take care of the baby, and then the mother says no. So it's really kind of convoluted and complex in the end. But the easiest thing to do is probably to say no if you don't have the contraceptives available.
Yes, and men have zillions of sperm, you know what I'm saying? A woman only has one egg. Woman does not have that many chances to have a baby. A man has lots more chances. And the woman, it is a very significant thing because it's in her body. So the woman really needs to have control of that situation, and even if the sperm provider, whether it is somebody who loves her or loves the child, or, you know, sperm providers can just put their sperm anywhere in the world, you know, they're easy for them. It's very easy. They just walk in and walk out again. But a woman has to carry, and if she carries a child to birth, then from the moment of inception, if she goes through with everything, from the moment of inception, which might have been just as a stupid little thing in the park, from the moment of inception, if she doesn't want to do anything about it, she's going to have a responsibility for the rest of her life. For the rest of her life, somebody is going to call her mom.
Unless she gives it up for adoption, she could always give the baby up for adoption. That's an option,
well,
too.
That's true.
Yeah.
But it really shouldn't be.
It's always options.
But it comes down to education and a philosophy of life to where we understand that, like, I came from a family where children were treasures, absolute treasures, you know. It was wonderful to have a child, and to have a child was just, you know, a marvelous thing because that's the way life was. But lots of times that's not the way life is. And if a mother knows ahead of time that that's what will happen to her and she won't be able to provide for that child, you know, she needs to have the right, but she needs to be educated also so that she understands the situation.
I agree with you so much, Mary Mann. You are such a delight and pleasure to speak with. I love speaking with you. You're so intelligent and so on it, so on these topics, and I just love it. And your book, There Are No Enemies, everyone should read it. It's fantastic. So now, Mary, unfortunately, again, we come to the end of the show, darn it. And it just goes so fast when I'm speaking to you and listening and learning myself and taking it all in, as well as the audience. Now you have your time to shine, and you can tell our listeners, you know, where they can get your books, any of the names of your books that you want them to read. And also, would you just explain real briefly how Aristotle influenced your philosophy in living and writing?
Yes, well, see, Aristotle began with the science of being altogether. And he was the one who showed us that that we are, that we do live in an integrated universe, that we all are part of this universe. You know, every little critter, everything is part of the universe, and that human beings, because they have intelligence, they really have the responsibility of being custodians of the planet. I'm not sure that he got that far, you know, Aristotle, but the integrated world is the gift that he gave us, the understanding that we're all part of an integrated universe, that we all belong to that universe. Nobody can push us out or do anything. That goes for everybody. We can't be pushed out. Nobody can really discriminate us against us as human beings, because we all belong to this universe, and all the little critters and all the stones and everything, everybody belongs. We all belong here. Nobody can shut us out of being part of the universe. And I think the integrated universe is what he taught us. And then the other philosophers, like starting Plato and Socrates, started teaching us how we can live together by using a democracy, which is voting, and by using the language, which is our intelligence has given us our language. So they started us off on this track of how we can grow, because, you know, let's face it, there were only a very few people in the world when Aristotle was alive. But the basis is there. You know, that's what he taught us. And all we have to do after that is learn how to live together peacefully with justice.
Thank you so much for that. And where can they get your book, and what is your website?
My website is Mary Anita Mann, and Anita is spelled AnnetaMann.com. But if you put in "there are no enemies," that's on Google. Even if you just Google "there are no enemies," it will show you what the website is. All of the books are on Amazon, and there are some plays, a lot of plays that I've written, youth and family plays. The latest one is Tortoiseshell. The latest publication is Tortoiseshell. People are interested in that because it's a book of history as well as a little play. It's a play taken from my great-great-grandfather. And then there's The Construction of Tragedy, which shows you that this thing that I was talking about, the movement of humanity to turning to the god of money instead of the god of the universe, and making it very difficult for us to get along together. And Science and Spirituality, which goes through all of the religions and shows how the religions can also, you know, help us in our journey. And what else? Oh, and then I have a little play, Thuggin and Natasha. Thuggin is a personified gun. And somebody wrote about that this little book can save this generation, because he's personified and he's put on trial together with the person who used him. So, it's not biased in any way. So Thuggin and Natasha is a very interesting little book. We toured it to students all over this area, and it helped them. And we've got little letters in the book about children, how it helped them.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Mary. Please come back, and we'll continue on with these topics.
Thanks a million. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You're so bye-bye. Welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Mary Anita Mann has left the building, and boy, what an exciting woman she is, because she has a lot of philosophies about world peace and making us a better world and bringing redistribution, so that not to take away capitalism, but to make it more fair. So I think that's very important, and not to destroy our planet while we're making money is very important as well. So God bless you. God bless America, and God bless our U.S. justices, our firefighters, our police, and of course our military and veterans. And we'll talk to you next Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. This is The Rose signing off. Bye-bye.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Colombo Chronicles.